little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about fasting and the questions related to fasting and Ramadan according to Ayatollah Khamenei. In the last program, you enumerated some of the invalidating agents of fast. But when it comes to eating and drinking, some people think that swallowing their saliva does make their fast void. Is it true?
That's not true. Saliva, no matter how much the quantity of the saliva gathered in your mouth cavity, will not affect your fast.
Right.
And therefore, it's not necessary to spit out or throw out your saliva to make sure that your fast is not made void. Okay, so it is permissible to swallow your saliva. And it's not going to affect your fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see. Thank you. What about eating food and drinking water because of extreme hunger or thirst or even physical weakness? Is it permissible to drink and eat at those times when people, in fact, feel that they are in a state of poor condition?
You're right. Well, weakness, you know, when you observe fast, especially in a hot season, you start dehydrating, okay?
Yes.
Losing water and feeling weak, okay? This is the natural effect and natural consequence of fasting. And every individual who fasts, he feels thirsty or hungry at the end of the day, and also he might feel weak. Okay,
yes.
Weakness is not a valid justification for for breaking your fast.
Yes.
Okay. But there's one thing we should note, and that is hunger and thirst, which is unbearable and which is normally unbearable, okay? Because لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها, God does not obligate, does not put a burden on someone beyond his capacity, beyond his individual ability. So when it becomes unbearable, of course, you can drink, you can eat, okay? And when it, especially when it's going to have a negative effect on your health, you cannot fast, okay?
Right.
So when it becomes unbearable, thirst becomes unbearable, or hunger becomes unbearable, you can drink as much as it can, as it it will be sufficient for you to observe fast for the rest of the day, okay? That day of fasting becomes white, but you still, you do not have the right to continue eating and to overeat and keep drinking water for the rest of the day, okay?
But the fast of that day
becomes white.
Becomes white.
Becomes white.
Right.
But out of respect for Ramadan, for the other mu'minin who are fasting, you shouldn't eat, okay, more than that amount of the amount necessary,
which is necessary
for staying up, for being able to work, and for staying healthy, okay. And as far as the qadha of that day is concerned, you should give the qadha of that day after the month of Ramadan.
No kafara is necessary?
There's no kafara. There's no kafara. Because you have broken your fast because of an urgent need to break it. Because of extreme hunger, extreme thirst, or because of the weakness that was unbearable for you.
I see. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
What about phlegm or sputum and mucus that is coming to the surface of the mouth? Some people feel it because of their health issues, all right? It is sometimes really difficult to get rid of that mucus from the mouth.
Yes.
Is it permissible for them to swallow that mucus, or does it make it make their fast void?
Yeah, you know, the phlegm or the sputum or the mucus, sometimes it's it is, you are not in control of it.
Yes,
it goes down or up.
It's
okay?
Very much sticky.
Yeah, it's sticky,
and it's too difficult to get rid of.
Yeah, to get rid of it, and sometimes no matter how hard you try to get rid of it, it is still there and it keeps hurting.
Exactly.
You. So
that's the
point. That case, of course, you can swallow it. And it is not going to affect your fast. But
it's like the condition of the saliva that we talked about before.
Yeah, of course. Just as saliva does not break your fast, the phlegm or the mucus that that is still that has not come up to the mouth cavity or to the surface of your mouth.
Yes,
you can swallow it, and it's not going to break your fast.
I see.
And let me also point to a difference in the opinion of Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani when it comes to the mucus or the phlegm, okay?
Yes.
Ayatollah Sistani says that, okay, the phlegm does not make the fast white, even if it comes to the surface of your mouth. Even if it comes, even if it's gathered in your mouth, it's better to just throw it away. Okay,
yes.
And people do throw it out. Okay, they do not because it's something disgusting.
Yes.
Okay,
of course they don't do it in the streets. They usually put it in a
of course
tissue and then they throw it into a dustbin.
Yeah,
or
that is something
can.
Else. Okay.
Yes.
But Ayatollah Khamenei says that when it comes to your mouth and when it's gathered there, you should throw it out, and it's not permissible to swallow it. Okay. Otherwise, your fast is going to be affected by swallowing.
I see.
Yes.
What about, Sheikh Sovit, what about gums? Sometimes we know that something happens like they are injured or because of like toothache, for example.
Sure.
All right. Their gums start bleeding.
Bleeding.
All right.
Yes.
What about this bleeding? Does it make the fast void?
Well, sometimes the gums start bleeding and the blood starts disappearing in the saliva. Okay?
Yes.
And when you check your saliva, you see no signs or no traces of blood in the saliva. And in that case, of course, the blood does not make your fast void, even if you swallow that saliva. Because it has disappeared. It's just something like it has evaporated in that sense, you know. There's no trace of blood in the saliva, so the saliva... there's no problem in swallowing the saliva, and it's not going to affect your fast.
So it is the criterion to
yes,
check out whether you can see, for example, blood in it, or it's just evaded into it. Like you can't see it, the blood is not visible. But what about the smelling? Some people can smell like iron. Something like iron, you know. Mm-hmm. Usually it's because of the iron of the blood.
You know, if you...
You can't see it. It's not visible, but you can smell it. You can smell the blood, basically. Does it make the fast void?
If you feel, if you just understand, if you know that there is blood in your saliva, if you know that your gum is bleeding,
mm-hmm.
so... but, you know...
It's not visible, but you can still smell it.
Smell, none of the religious authorities has said that the smell will make your fast void, uh-huh. okay? Because you cannot swallow smell.
I'm not talking about the smell itself. I'm talking about the existence, the reason for the existence, mm-hmm, or the evidence,
for the evidence
that there is the blood in your saliva, although it is not visible.
Okay, but even then, Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, has said that you can swallow, because it's not considered in common sense,
mm-hmm.
in common view. It's not considered drinking or eating or swallowing your blood, the blood that comes out or oozes out of the
right,
of
gums.
The gum. Okay, when it is visible, of course, it's haram, whether you're fasting or not fasting. Mm-hmm. When it comes out...
So you have to spit it out.
You have to spit it out, and it becomes haram, no matter whether you're
fasting.
Sorry
for the interruption. You were saying...
I was trying to say that, okay, when blood is there, mm-hmm. and you can see it, whether you're fasting or you're not fasting, swallowing it becomes haram. But if you're fasting, it will make your fast void.
Thank you very much. There are many more questions that I hopefully, God willing, will ask you in the next episodes to come. Thank you very much for accepting our offer and coming to the studio and shedding some light on these questions related to this special holy month of Ramadan. If there is a cream of the crop for everything, if there is a bride for everything, I guess that Ramadan is the cream of the crop, the bride of all months that there are to it in these 12 months. So please keep us in your du'as, especially in this holy month. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu kutiba alaykumus.
O you have faith, prescribed for you is fasting, as it was prescribed for those who were before you, so that you may be God-wary.
رمضان زمان الحسنات
رمضان زمان البركات رمضان زمان الحسنات رمضان زمان البركات رمضان
مجال الصلوات تسمو بالنفس لمولاها
رمضان مجال الصلوات تسمو بالنفس لمولاها
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, and welcome back to The Month of Allah. In the last program, we talked about the different aspects of how to eat, and I will continue with the same question and try to answer the question. We reached number 3. The sentence of Bismillah should be said before eating the food, and that is to give thanks. Why do we do that? We say thanks to Allah for all the benefits that Allah has given us, and we start every act and deed with the name of Allah. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if someone starts his eating with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I would guarantee that person that he would not be inflicted with any suffering or disease or pain or distress from that food. Bismillah contains the word of Allah. You have the word of Allah in the sentence of Bismillah. And Allah, when you read and study the Qur'an and the Ahadith, you see that the different names of Allah have different traits or attributes of Allah. They're referring to a certain trait or attribute of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the name of Allah in itself is a comprehensive name. It contains all the different traits and attributes within it in the name of Allah. Number 4. Halal livelihood. Now, Islam emphasizes a lot on this aspect, that where from have you taken or gotten your livelihood? Because it does not matter if your livelihood is haram and you spend with that haram money on halal food, that the bad aspects of that food or that money that you have brought in your house will affect your behavior and your moral traits and so on and so forth. Therefore, a lot of emphasis has been placed on halal livelihood. Occasionally, we see some people who have difficulties taking any job. They want a job who would fit their personal status in the society, or they say that maybe this certain job is not fit for someone like me, or I don't want to do any job that has to do with my hands or trade and so on and so forth. How do we deal with it? It seems like someone came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and he said, I am in a huge need, but I do not like to work with my hands or do any trade. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam responds and says, work although it is a burden for you, so that you do not become in need of others. We will continue with the same question of how to eat in the coming programs, inshallah ta'ala. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded police chief Darryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Do, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me they're gonna save them. Save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real.
It felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity. Empowerment. They're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And When you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that, and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you. Otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, or, you know, violent African American. And of course what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it, I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, it still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's enmasked it, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms has been told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, youth.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
Sure. One of the many issues that came up during his time as the chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates, and of course we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific. And Darryl Gates, I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years. And so the film goes over, you know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darryl Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But, you know, you go, okay, well, then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now, again,
that is a
excuse
very
it,
complex
but it's
story.
It's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And, Serge, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying, I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not a policy was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like Southam, which is where I come from, which has had riots, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm. And they used a lead-gauge baton to kill him in 1979. Mm. In Mark Durgan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse
indeed.
That.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. Mm. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, mm-hmm. It's a very, you know, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. You know, with 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote the screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual sort of... mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and, you know, trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and you know, nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, you know, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, you know, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, you know, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of it.
Of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, you know, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, you know, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, you know, some sort of, you know, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. But yeah, it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. You know, public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues, and one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victims, there's instead a time of the bomb perpetrators.
That comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's God, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and if, after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS.
Well, we'll just pause there for now, as John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that, yeah.
You know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean, I mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, that's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues. Whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why all the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force, the manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal looting, the police officers walked free.
They walked free in Rodney King's case as far as the district was concerned, but obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial.
Of course.
And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice
system.
The
differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Huey Newton in the black power movement. There are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Tottenham Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, mm-hmm. women and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which, mm-hmm. again, covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism, and it's also good filmmaking, and when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding, and then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
Gifted and Safi, Ramadan Mubarak, Goli Records.
Ramadan Mubarak, لكل مسلم شهر لذيذ فيها ينزل القرآن. Happy Ramadan to all Muslims. All the Quran descends in this holy month.
Insights into the Holy Quran, a special program for the holy month of Ramadan.
Welcome you, O holy man of blessings. Oh, yeah. You are seeking nearness to my Creator, for you my soul and heart has been purified.
Oh my God.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends, but we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go, 'cause your time is set by Allah. Oh Ramadan, oh Ramadan, you're the month of the noble Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya
O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
Brothers and sisters, the verse that we were talking about was the verse in chapter Baqarah. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. O you who believe, fasting is prescribed for you as it was prescribed before you, that you may gain self-restraint. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. We mentioned in this regard that this taqwa can be achieved by not just stopping at the first level of fasting, which was just the jurisprudential level. This taqwa cannot be achieved merely by refraining yourself from eating and drinking. Now let's just get to the most important question in our discussion. What is the meaning of taqwa? I mean, what does it really mean? The word taqwa, or piety, means to fear Allah and to guard against evil. And it is, you may have seen that it is frequently used by experts, and it has been recommended by so many people. There are different verses in the Holy Quran that can help us have a better view on this word. One meaning is fear and awe. The Holy Quran says, "Me alone should you fear." In some other verse, it has been used in the meaning of obedience and worship. The Holy Quran says, "Be careful of your duty to Allah with the care that which is due to Him." حَقَّ تُقَاتِ. It has also been used as purifying the hearts from the sins. The Holy Quran says, "And he who obeys Allah and His Apostle and fears Allah and is careful of his duty to Him, these it is that are the achievers." Some believe, dear listeners, that this last meaning is the real meaning of taqwa, and not the first two meanings, that is, obedience or fear.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد منكم الشهر فليصم ومن كان مريضا أو على سفر فعدة من أيام أخر يريد الله بكم اليسر ولا يريد بكم العسر ولتكملوا العدة ولتكبروا الله على ما هداكم ولعلكم تشكرون.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Taqwa originally comes from the word waqaya, which means to ban and to keep away. It is also said that taqwa comes from waqaya, meaning safeguard or protection. Now let's discuss the views of some lexicographers regarding this word. Raghib says, waqaya is to keep the thing from what harms it, and taqwa is to guard self from what it fears. He further adds that taqwa is to guard self against sin. Its realization depends on abandoning what has been generally forbidden and even some of the permissible acts. In this regard, Allama Majlisi, may his soul rest in peace, says taqwa means to safeguard, it means self-restraint, and generally speaking, it means to keep self from what harms it in hereafter. And the more it is restricted, it will be better for the self. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been quoted as saying, taqwa is to avoid sins. Also, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when he was asked about the meaning of taqwa, said, taqwa is to be present in a place God has ordered, and to be absent from a place He has prohibited. A great part of supplications signify the same meaning. O Allah, find me not in a place You have forbidden. And this could help us to reach the general total meaning of taqwa. So, from what we discussed, we can infer that taqwa is self-restraint and safeguarding yourself from what is against the Lord, what is against the Almighty Allah has ordered. In this way, taqwa can cover all the meanings that we mentioned. It has a sense of fear, it has a sense of obedience and worship, and it also has the sense of purifying the heart. And fasting, if done in the correct way, can help us achieve this piety or self-restraint. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We'll be right back.
Thank you to your listeners of IRB English Radio for listening to us. If you have any question or comment, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at farstoday.com. May Allah accept your deeds in this holy month of Ramadan, and please include all Muslims in your prayers. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Lord Allah, please forgive us and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
پیغمبر فرمود تو همون خطبه شبانیش فرمود که ایها الناس ان انفسکم مرهونتون به